ask each one of them if they would have any comments on the election results from last evening. And Secretary Berglund, you can start.
No surprises. I'm one who believes in the value of poll taking. I know it's people tend to poo-poo and criticize, but truth of the matter is it's good marketing. They know what they're doing. It changes from hour to hour because attitudes change. But the results were just about as the poll takers predicted, and so there were no surprises. The question is, where do we go from here? And what the one thing that is very much unclear is what the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives is going to do. They have veto control. The Senate can take an action. It can go to the House for consideration, and the Senate or the House of Representatives has to agree to something or nothing. And up until now, it's been nothing. And Chairman or the Majority Leader in the House, Congressman Boehner from Indiana, is a very fine man, a good guy, good sense, an honorable fellow, an honest guy. And he's trying to get his caucus to agree on a provision or provisions in the new farm bill that up till now they've not been willing to do. And so they had to postpone the vote on it, and it'll come back up again here and soon, I think, in the lame duck session. I have no clue how that thing will turn out. We'll see.
Okay, I guess my thoughts are about the election is that it was a close election. If things had turned one way or the other, it could have gone the other way. But think about it this way. After a whole year of debating and all kinds of ads and money spent and the whole thing, and that's the American system, nothing has changed. I mean, we have the same president for four more years that didn't get anything done. We have Harry Reid who's going to run the Senate again. They never even put forth a budget. Never put forth a budget in the last 3 years, so we don't know what we're supposed to do. And any farm or family's got to have a little idea of how much money they're going to take in and how much money they're going to spend. But the federal government, the biggest operation, the biggest corporation of all, hasn't even had a budget. I mean, it's indefensible, and we have a huge debt on our shoulders. So it's going to be a real challenge there. The House of Representatives has not changed. Virtually the same number of Republicans, and their philosophy has not changed. So you're going to have one side saying, we'll tax the rich, the other side saying, no new taxes. So where are we? Well, I think it remains to be seen. I'm a born optimist, so I'm kind of hopeful that everybody will step back and take a new look and realize if we got the fiscal cliff of $600 billion of tax increases and government spending cuts that are facing us the first of the year, and that's going to be automatic if we don't deal with that, we're going to have another occasion here, I think, in February. We're going to have to vote to expand the debt of the country, and we're taking on debt every year of $1 trillion. We're up to $16 trillion. It's totally unsustainable. Europe is in deep trouble because they have spent way more money than they can afford to spend. And it's time the United States kind of took a lesson. Look across the water over there and look where they're at. And we don't want to be living like Greece. So I think we've got a lot of challenges on our shoulders. We've got smart people, good people, but they've just got to sit down and fix some of these problems. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to be very painful. And I'd say this whole political race this year, they didn't talk enough about the real problems. They got into all kinds of social junk and so forth. I know that's important to some people, but the serious problems are our debt, our spending, and our screwed up tax system. We've got to deal with these kind of things, and it didn't get enough attention. And so when the Congress now finds they really need to deal with these things, They're afraid to do it. They wouldn't touch them all this last year. The only person to put out a decent budget was Paul Ryan, the House budget, and the Senate wouldn't vote on it. We got a lot of challenges ahead of us. That's where I am.
Jack and I will show our political biases a bit here, as will Bob. But, you know, that's what makes this country tick. I'm not sure how well it ticks sometimes, but let me give my a few additional comments. I would basically say amen to what everything that Jack had to say there. In terms of the farm bill, you know, Bob will eventually get a farm bill. I'm not sure it'll get done in the lame duck session. It will be discussed in the lame duck session, but whether or not you can incorporate it into something that will pass is another question entirely. I still think the chances of that happening are probably less than 50-50, which means that they would do something temporary and kick the can down the road a bit and then deal with it next year. The big problem with that, of course, is everybody here knows, is that the Senate, which has already passed the bill, has to start over. It's a new Congress, so you'd have to run that same legislation through the Senate again, which would probably happen, and with essentially no change, maybe no change whatsoever. And the House would still have to act, and thus far, the votes are just simply not there in the House to pass this legislation. But eventually, it'll get done because. You know, the Congress is not going to leave American agriculture with no safety net at all. That just isn't going to happen. It'll be a safety net based much more on crop insurance than anything else. That's a substantial change from the past. But at any rate, that will eventually happen. But back to the, you know, I think what's really challenging this country is, what do we do about $1 trillion deficits? That just cannot go on. And as Jack mentioned, nobody took that on in this election. It's not surprising that President Obama chose not to do so, because his political support emanates from groups who are the beneficiaries of a lot of that $1 trillion deficit. And, you know, we're really talking about entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and, of course, Social Security, and then even programs that dip into USDA, like food stamps. We've got huge, huge deficits in these areas. And, you know, ideas to deal with those head on did not surface in the election. I wish they had on our side, simply because I think somebody has to have the courage to do so. I went out and campaigned in Iowa for a day on behalf of Governor Romney, and one of the things they said to me was, don't say anything about entitlements while you're here. I thought to myself, yeah, you know, you guys don't want to talk about entitlements at all, for heaven's sakes. You know, demonstrate a little courage. But they didn't talk about entitlements, and you know good and well President Obama did not talk about entitlements. He spent the entire campaign, or his organization did, seeking to destroy his opponent, and they spent billions and billions of dollars in doing so in campaign funding, as everybody here knows. That's not a recipe for leadership either. So we've had very little leadership on either side. And you don't see anybody in the Congress that's stepping up on this either, with a few exceptions, including Congressman Ryan. Unless we're prepared as a nation to be straight about this and tell people in our generation, hey, look what you're doing to your kids and your grandkids. If we're not willing to do that, nothing much is going to happen. It took the Obama administration almost 3 years to send over the free trade agreements on Panama, Korea, and Colombia. They should have been over the first day of the Obama administration. Sitting on them for 3 years cost American agriculture a lot of money, and there was no reason to do that. Why did they sit there? Because of opposition from the labor unions. And when you've got your constituencies are labor unions and the beneficiaries of the entitlement programs, you know, reform, leadership reform coming out of the presidency is really, really difficult. What we have to hope, being optimistic about it, as Jack is, that you now have a lame duck president who doesn't have to run again, and hopefully he'll be willing to take some political risks with his own constituencies that he was unwilling to do so in his first term. I think that's enough for now. Let's go to some questions.
You could absolutely.
Just to comment on what Secretary Yoder had to say, the Social Security program can be fixed by changing, tinkering with the contributions and other elements of the program, kind of minor sort of changing. Medicare is a different matter. And the problem in Medicare is that half the money paid out on Medicare is spent in the last 3 months of our life. The end of life cost in this country is enormous. We'll do anything to keep our friends and loved ones alive for another week or month or two. And how do you deal with that? You think people want to talk about it? Of course not. People complain about it, but when it comes to finding a remedy, will not. They're not about to pull the plug on my grandma. She may not live more than a month longer. They're not going to do it. And you can't expect people to do it. It's a kind of thing that is so terribly, terribly complicated and difficult because of the aspects of it involved. I think what we're going to eventually have to do is just decide that we're going to keep grandma alive. We're going to pay these end-of-life costs, even though they are horrendous, and we're going to set aside the money to do it.
No, I agree. Medicare is going to be very costly. I don't know the answer to it. But on Social Security, I want to say something about Social Security. When Social Security was enacted under Roosevelt, and everybody talks about how wonderful it was that he had this idea to have Social Security for everyone, pay in so they have a way to live after they get ready to retire. And okay, that was fine. But at that time, you're only supposed to live to where you were 65 years old. And Social Security started then. So you're supposed to be dead anyway. But today, lifespan is much more. We ought to fix Social Security by increasing the retirement age. People are healthy longer. There's no question about it. Why would we keep it back there? Of course, you look at Europe, some have gone back to 58 or 60 years old or younger than that. I don't know. And that's one reason why they're in trouble. We cannot do this. We got to live with reality. Now, that's my few words on Social Security.
All right, we're going to go to some questions. All right,
and that's not even a farm bill.
First question, Ken Root.
Well, gentlemen, first of all, it's an honor, I think, for all of us, for you three, to take your time to come here, because you're so entwined with our organization and the coverage we had of you in years past. And I guess I would consider you, Mr. Berglund, beginning the first modern secretary with AB after Butts. Been into this industry because he was more infamous than the three of you, but a most remarkable secretary at that time. My question is about the secretaries of agriculture of late, with nothing disparaging about them. We've had governors. Is it too sophisticated a job, too political a job for a farmer to be secretary of agriculture in the future?
No, it is not. All you got to do is have the nerve to say no. Earl Butts was an iconic friend of mine. I didn't know him well, and he and I were polar opposites politically. He was a hard case conservative, and I was a left of center Democrat. But I admired him, and the manner in which he dealt with tough problems. And shortly after I was sworn in, Earl Butts called and he said he'd like to come and see me. And I said, no, I'll come and see you. He said, no, you won't do any such thing. So he came over and he said, this is when the agriculture movements were starting to get fired up and a lot of commotion, and the flames were being fanned by a lot of people who wanted to embarrass us. And he said, what you got to do with these people is just stand your ground. Don't give an inch. Because you give an inch, they're going to take a mile. And so I got the advice without fear or favor. I took his advice and found out he was right. He was one of my heroes.
He's one of my heroes too, Ken, because I served under him as in what would that today be a couple of undersecretary slots at the tail end of the Nixon administration. And he was a great, great secretary. But Bob, I have to tell you that when it comes to saying no, he was unhesitant about delegating to his undersecretaries. Because, as you know, food prices increased rapidly in the 70s when the Russians entered the market. I was involved in all of that, but we had consumer groups protesting around the walking around the department, Ken, carrying signs saying "Down with Butts, Butts go home, go back to Indiana," and all that kind of thing. And they always wanted to come in and meet with him. And every time they asked for a meeting with him, my phone would ring, and he'd say, "I'm not going to meet with those so and so. You go meet with them." So I had the task of saying no.
Again, we ask you to state your name and your affiliation, and then your question.
Thanks. I'm Jeff Henley from Cromwell Ag Radio Network. Secretary Yard, if I could ask you,
sure.
Do you understand that the Obama administration now with his reelection, they'll be looking toward streamlining some government agencies, U.S. Trade Representative's office into the Commerce Department? We also understand that not publicly, but there's been some work with the European government, perhaps of a free trade deal between the two sides of the big pond. What are your thoughts on streamlining, and what are your thoughts on any kind of trade deal with the European continent?
Okay. Two good questions. I'll do the last one first, because we can do that pretty quickly. I'm an advocate of having a U.S.-European Union free trade agreement at some point, because I believe it'll be good for both the U.S. and the European Union, and I believe we can do it on agriculture. A lot of people will say, well, gee, there's such a difference between the agricultural systems, you'll never be able to mesh those differences and work it out so that you could have a satisfactory negotiation. I don't agree with that. The Europeans have significantly reformed the common agricultural policy over the last 20 years. They've got a long way yet to go. But our two systems are much closer together than they were 10, 15, and 20 years ago. So I don't see that as a stumbling block. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, however, because the Europeans have other problems that they've got to deal with. And even though this would help them in terms of economic development, they've got to get a hold on some of their more serious problems. In addition to which, we have a major negotiation underway here in the U.S. called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP negotiations involving Pacific Rim countries, and we've got a lot of resources, government resources and private sector resources, devoted to that negotiation. If and when Japan comes into that negotiation, that'll become a really big deal. And that'll be first priority over anything that would happen with the U.S. European Union. So that takes care of that one. And let's see, the first question was...
Streamlining, was that right?
Streamlining the government. I think there'll be a couple things happen there. One, where you folks in agriculture are particularly interested, there's a lot of support within the agricultural community to creating an international undersecretary at USDA, an undersecretary that would really focus totally on the international issues of importance to agriculture. Now, we've got a deputy undersecretary that does that today, deputy undersecretary is a rank that's, it doesn't carry the clout of an undersecretary. There is a good chance, in my view, that legislation would pass next year, creating an undersecretary, and I think that would be a positive step forward, just because it gives that person the additional political clout to do things in the international arena. And we're going to be living in the international arena for the rest of our lives, whether we like it or not. And we need to focus on that in the private sector and in government. So that's one thing. Your specific question, though, related to what's going to happen in the trade organization, because President Obama indicated a couple years ago already that he thought we ought to reorganize trade and put a whole bunch of things together, including putting USTR into the Commerce Department, and the possibility also of taking the Foreign Agricultural Service out of USDA and putting it into this new department. That obviously didn't sell too well with anybody in the agricultural community. The folks who were dealing with this on the White House staff came over and spent an hour or so with me to talk about this, and it's always interesting to talk to people who want to reorganize government because they don't realize how difficult it is. When they asked about can we take the Foreign Agricultural Service out of USDA and move it into this new organization, I told them to forget it, that there was no way that that was going to happen, so don't waste any time on it and move elsewhere. Then they asked whether they could move USTR into the Commerce Department, and I told them they better forget that too. There would be huge opposition to doing that. There are some things that can be consolidated in the international trade, international economic arena, some of which they had in mind, but the big ones like that are not going to happen. I think USTR is the most effective, efficient organization in the entire U.S. government and has been for many, many years. Why would you try to fix something that not only is not broke, but is an example for everything else in the U.S. government? There is no entity in the world comparable to USTR. It's the best in the business. It is the best in the world and has been for a long time. And we should not even think about messing with it.
You know, related to that whole subject of reorganization, for a long time, there's been some talk about the Department of Agriculture is becoming a department relating or dealing with nutrition programs. 60-70% of the money spent, or more than that, is nutrition programs. And that's food stamps and school lunch programs and so forth. And say maybe we ought to send those over to the Food and Drug Administration or someplace else and have the farm. The Department of Agriculture just be farming and ranching and agriculture. Well, my judgment is that would be a huge mistake. We'd lose so much clout. We would lose our cabinet level position before too long because we don't have enough farmers. So we need to keep the food business as close in the Department of Agriculture if we can. And I've advocated we ought to rename the Department of Agriculture the Department of Food, Agriculture, and Forestry, and give it the name of what it does. That's my thought on it.
Mike Adams.
Get a farm bill passed on its own, or are we still dependent now on basically 80% of the ag budget being with the nutrition program?
Well, I think that you need to keep them together. I know that there's differences of opinion, and we've got to fight about some things there. And somehow, listen, we're going to take our lumps on farm programs. They're changing all the time, as they have been. It's been an evolutionary process. It's not new. And so we're, the direct payments are going to be history, and then we'll go to, you know, more of a insurance-type program of some kind. So we'll have these differences of opinion with the food nutrition programs, but I think they need to stay together, in my judgment. I think we'd lose not only clout, we'd lose our reputation, and, you know, I just, it would be, I think, a very bad move.
If I may, I'd like to add to that, because I think there is an answer. First of all, I fully agree with Jack. We agriculturalists cannot afford to have that split be made. One could argue it in terms of governmental reorganization and where do things fit. But you can't start from scratch and establish things the way you might like. I can remember President Nixon wanting to get the government down to 6 major departments, and he tried that out on the Congress, and it got shot down very, very quickly, which showed me immediately, way back in those years, the government reorganization is hard. But I agree with all the arguments that Jack made of why we need to keep it all together. The problem, though, this time is not that we really need to get food programs out of there because of the hassle over the budget. The problem is that the food programs have gotten mucked up. We need to fix the doggone food programs, and then there won't be any problem in doing it. The problem is that the food programs have become too expensive. In particular, food stamps have become too expensive. And the reason for that is we have the poverty level too high. We have way too many people getting food stamps who ought not be on food stamps at all. And that's because we've let the poverty level creep up beyond what is really poverty. And we need to fix that as a nation. And it applies not just in food stamps, but in some of the other welfare-related kind of programs as well. But it really hits us on food stamps because we have, what, 40-some million people on food stamps right now? You know good and well we don't have 40-some million people who deserve to be on food stamps in this country. If we did, if we got that problem fixed, we'd be okay.
I have a solution. We got too many people on food stamps. We also happen to have too many people that are obese. And I say, when they apply for food stamps, they have to weigh in. And if they weigh too much, they can come back later when they don't weigh so much. And then in the schools, you know, all these kids want to get the free lunch or subsidized lunches and eat all they want. They have to weigh in too. And if they weigh too much, it's a salad bar. That's it.
Good luck.
And they don't get potatoes and gravy. Now, I know this is all BS. You can't get it done. But listen, we do have a problem. And there's an awfully lot of people on food stamps that are not that damned hungry. And we know it.
I have just one word. I agree that this obesity thing is a major national health problem, and we're not here to discuss that necessarily. But I want to talk about the food stamp thing. We have so many people on food stamps because we have so many people that are poor. The way you fix the food stamp problem is raise the minimum wage. Make it worthwhile to have a job. And then they'll be getting off the food stamp rolls. Now, that doesn't go very good in many audiences, but I want you to know what
including
I think.
Including this one.
Evan Slack.
Evan Slack, out west. I had the pleasure of working with all three of you. You're quite different. I salute you because you work with the people on the land who help make for the good life for all the rest of us. And Mr. Eustace, Nebraska, Earl the Pearl Butts used to stop by KOA on his way to Vail for speaking engagements. So.
At Vail.
And Dr. John, exactly. And Well, talking about Bill Armstrong, he and I are best of friends, and you touched on base or my area in Colorado with the American agriculture movement, Mr. Berglund. I can relate and appreciate what you went through there. And I'd like to comment just outside of agriculture. A lot of us out west are concerned about EPA, and particularly dust and water.
I just want to say
about
that
EPA? Talk about the Environmental Protection Agency?
Yeah, I will just predict that now that we've got a second term of President Obama, that there's a whole flood of regulations that are stacked up that have not been acted on and not been pushed forward because of the election. Now that he has four more years, you're going to see a lot more regulations, and they're going to, and it won't just be EPA, it'll be other organizations too. Now that's my prediction, because I think that you know, that was a plan, that's what they wanted to do, and now they have a chance.
You're talking
to do
about
it.
To the detriment of the economy and agriculture specifically,
everything.
Or
yeah, economy and agriculture. Yeah, we'll pay a price.
Absolutely, and Colorado will not be exempt. You're going to get your chair out there. So get ready for it in Denver. You know, look at Vail and Keystone and all those good, wonderful ski resorts are going to get regulated some more, too.
Go ahead.
Roger Ward, WLDS, Jacksonville. Oh, if Mr. Burke.
I just want to urge a word of caution on this business of abandoning regulation. We just had a problem in Minnesota with a meatpacking company that was selling meat that was not fit to be eaten. That sort of thing can happen. EPA or the Food and Drug Administration or other regulatory agencies ride herd on that stuff all the time. If they find a way they can make money by cheating on the label, they will. Or they might. And so we erect these barriers, clumsy though they be. But the fear is that the alternative to tough regulation will be some terrible abuses.
Go ahead, Roger.
Okay, Roger Ward, WLDS, Jacksonville, Illinois. I had the privilege of farming under all of you as secretaries and still do. Kind of in that same vein, it's one thing to farm under farm programs and the importance of a farm program. How serious should agriculture take the fact that now we're having to farm under the rules and regulations of those who purchase our products and those who have no knowledge of how we produce our products?
Let me tell you a personal experience, and I'm not going to get into all the details, but very quickly. We raise hogs on our farm, about 8,000 a year. We're not huge, but for a family farm, that's a pretty decent hog production operation. And we've sold our hogs for years to Tyson, and which is fine. They've been a good buyer. We've sold them sometimes to other places, but that's the main buyer of our market hogs. And we raise them farrow to finish. They're absolutely beautiful hogs. They're happy and they do well. And it's a very efficient farm family operation. Now I get a letter from Tyson's, and now they want to come and audit how we take care of our pigs. Are they properly cared for? Are they given the proper loving care day and night? And they even got a list of things that make sure that the guys that work with these pigs on my farm understand things. They got a list of questions, and they say, how do you pick up a pig? Just to be sure my guys understand this. They say, by the tail? No. By the ear? By the front hind leg? By the front leg? Everybody knows you pick up a baby pig by the hind leg. I knew that when I was 5 years old. They have a stupid thing like that they're sending out for us to look at. Now, why is this happening? It's not because of Tyson. It's because Tyson is being pressured by Humane Society to say, oh, I don't know if the farmers are taking good care of their animals. So Tyson's going to impose this on the suppliers of pigs to them. I just say, listen, maybe I'm getting too old, but this is just going too far. I don't know where it's going to happen, but we're going to do it. I mean, because my pigs are happy. I mean, they are good, happy pigs. And we don't even use gestation crates. And they're not requiring gestation crates, I might add that. So the first thing that the Humane Society jumped on and said, well, you're going to audit farmers, but you're not making them use or get rid of their gestation crates. So, you know, story.
No, I would only add that to what Jack said by saying that I think in terms of government regulation and in terms of the kind of thing Jack was talking about, we've got to be really careful that we have some balance there. You know, Bob Berglund is right that, you know, we need to develop and engender consumer confidence, and we've got to try to do the right thing for the consumers of food products, and we don't want the kind of problems that make the press stories and call for huge recalls of food and that kind of thing. And that requires effective meat and poultry inspection in USDA and much better inspection by FDA, which has been a big problem, much more so in FDA than in USDA. But it requires some common sense out of those regulatory agencies and common sense out of EPA, too, which hasn't demonstrated a whole lot in recent years. And then it seems to me that some of the people in the food industry, Tyson's being among them, when somebody is proposing unreasonable actions to be insisted by Tysons on the Jack Blocks of the world, they need to stand up and be counted. Unfortunately, in many cases, they're not willing to do that. And then the problem gets passed back to the farm level, and you get additional costs involved in a lot of things that really do not make sense.
Mike.
Mike Hergert with the Red River Farm Network in Grand Forks. Thank you for being here. We've always enjoyed your accessibility. Especially nice to see our neighbor, Mr. Berglund. It seems to me there's a couple of schools of thought. Some think that farmers will always, as they always have, overproduce for these good times. Others say we can't produce enough for the growing demand. How do you see it?
Go ahead and start it, Bob.
I was born in 1928 on a farm in Minnesota on the Canadian border. There were 7 million family farms in the United States at that time. 7 million. I don't know what the number is now, but 500,000 maybe?
Yeah,
or something
less,
like that.
Commercial, or less.
I lived through a time when the farm work was done by hand or by horse. And in my lifetime, we've gone from hand and horse to computer and satellites. In one lifetime. The result of all this technology is just unbelievable. And it's not ending yet, nor should it. I think that we're going to be up to the challenge. There's going to be expanded trade with the world, as these gentlemen have talked about. That is so vital. The United States cannot be an island unto itself. For a lot of reasons, that'd be a horrible mistake. For one, we'll have to go to war every other week. And so trade is crucial. And the world's population will continue to grow. And many of those countries don't have the land to feed their own population more than a bare minimum diet. And if they're going to expand their diet to include some meats and other things that we take for granted, they're going to have to import it. The United States will be able to meet that requirement because we have this technology that enables us to grow these tremendous crop supplies, and there'll be some changes made in the meantime. I know it takes, you know, with the drought this year and the price of grain that's gone up, putting real strain on the livestock industry, the feeding aspects of it. But this will change, I suppose. But eventually, we may eat more cereal and less meat. Eventually. That may come because of the growing population in the world. We can't feed everybody all the time. We can just take care of some of the incremental growth.
Any other thoughts on overproduction?
The specific answer to your question, and it's really a good question, is one of the key questions for everybody in the world to ask these days. I think the simple answer to your question is that nobody knows. You have a lot of experts who are expressing their opinions on this subject, but they do not know. So let's just look at a couple aspects of it. The first one is that we could feed a whole lot more people in this world just by eliminating half or more of the waste that exists today. We probably waste in the world a third or so of all the food that's produced. We can feed a whole lot more people if you reduce that dramatically. And there are ways to do that. So that's one factor. Secondly, I don't think we're through improving technology either. Some suggest that the pace of advancing technology is slowing down, but it's still pretty darn good. And American farmers are getting better and better and better. I look back at my state of Nebraska and the situation that existed when I grew up. There were a lot of pretty lousy farmers still around in the 1940s. There aren't very many of those around these days. Farmers have gotten better and better and more productive and more productive. But I think that's going to continue to happen. And then we're going to add farmers in places like Brazil who are getting better by the day. And that's going to accelerate in a big way with the kind of farm prices that exist today. So my view is that it's not going to be as nearly as big a problem to feed the people of the world between now and 2050 as many folks prognosticate today. The world is going to get that done between now and 2050. I can't see beyond that. That's too far out. However, there's some aspects to that that are critical in the short run, and one is that we have farmland prices now that are up at astronomical levels, way beyond anything that we've seen in the past. And the question is, can we make those prices, $10,000-$15,000 an acre, work? I get a little worried about that. I remember going through that in the 70s at somewhat lower prices when we had the same kind of spikes. We paid dearly for that in the 1980s, as Jack Block will remember better than anybody else. We better just be a little bit careful that we don't repeat history once again. I think our farmers, fortunately, who are buying at these kinds of prices are in better shape financially than they were in the 70s, but they better be in pretty darn good shape if they're going to amortize $10,000 to $15,000 an acre land.
Yeah, I would want to agree entirely with Clayton and Bob too. A sidebar on that is there's a lot of debate about food versus fuel, and I don't want to get too deep into it, except to just say that that's just another market for grain. That it's a market. And if we had a new country in the world said, we want to buy your grain, we'd sell it to them. Well, we've got a market in making biofuels. It's a reality. And ethanol is cheaper than oil-based gasoline by about a dollar. And so I think it's probably going to continue to be there, unless something dramatic happens to the cost of oil and the cost of energy. I don't know how long it'll stay like that. So I think the markets are going to go up and down. I would agree that the prices are really high on land and grains and corn. I mean, $8 corn, I never imagined that ever. So it goes down. It may go down some. We've lived this roller coaster all of our lives in agriculture. and I don't think that's going to change. But when the market changes, then it kind of is telling us, well, we don't want as much of that. We want more of something else. And it happens all the time. And then farmers and agriculturalists react to it. And with high-priced grains, we're going to see some things happening in parts of the world that have not been producing. In Africa, there's a huge amount of unutilized land and improperly managed land. Well, listen, at a price, let me tell you, somebody's going to go over there and make it work. We just have to wait and see.
I'll just summarize that in 30 seconds because it gets back to Earl Butz. I can remember Earl Butz saying over and over again, the antidote to high prices is high prices, and the antidote to low prices is low prices.
That's right.
And of course he was right, but he came at it a little bit crude in his in his manner, but his logic was sound. I want to just add a bit to this phenomenon, land prices and what's happening here. Half of the land in the United States is tenant farmed, rented land. And these contracts usually are for a certain period of time, often just annual. The landowners, either through an agent or by themselves, are going to get every dime they can get from that contract. And when the land is up for sale, it's going to go to the highest bidder. And there's a feeding frenzy going on right now because of $15 beans and corn and wheat. Higher prices than we can ever remember. All of this money is going to be put into land, all of it. It is the ultimate sop. It'll soak up everything there is and want more. This thing is going to crash and burn. I don't think there's any easy way to get off this high horse. This thing is going to go until it blows up and then hang on for a wild ride.
Mary?
Mary McKenna, Farm Director at KFEQ, and you started when you started talking about ethanol, broaching my next question, it's a twofold question. Now that the election is over, where do you see the renewable fuel standard, the RFS, and what the current administration will do about that? And there are people who consider it a subsidy. It's subsidizing corn farmers. So my question, where do you draw the line between what you consider an entitlement and what's a subsidy?
Well, it's a hard thing, but I have a general rule that would handle this whole word. I am dead set against any subsidy. I am a strong advocate of a market-based economy, and subsidies just followed up to fare thee well. We give subsidies to meet some political demand, and then wonder why the wheels fell off. I think because of the heavy pressure that's going to build on the budget and cutting spending, that the administration is going to have a plan to eliminate all subsidies in agriculture, all of them, every single one, and put everybody on the same plane. That'd be a good thing to do, and I'd applaud it.
Will he eliminate the subsidies for wind and solar?
Well, as far as I know, they come free of charge.
They're huge.
How about the building of the wind machines and solar power?
Yeah, that's a different matter. Right. I don't mean to make light of this. There are subsidies in this this thing at the prevailing prices for energy. That's true. What will it be like in 20 years? Who knows? I think we're going to see a major shift in American consumer habits on energy, shifting out of coal, and I know what a hot potato that is, into natural gas. And that's going to change everything for a long time. But eventually, those things are going to get very high priced. These are not renewable fuels. These things have an end. We hope we don't see it in our lifetime, but it will end someday. We're kind of on the tail end of the coal mining business. Maybe we got coal for some few years yet, but it's not forever. We have no idea how big and extensive these gas reserves are, even though they're big now. Will they last 100 years? Nobody knows. And so what we need to do as a nation is kind of be ready for whatever happens. Be nimble.
My view is that EPA will probably not do anything with the proposal that's on their desk at the moment. They obviously deliberately postponed it until after the election, which from their standpoint was a wise thing to do and wise thing from the White House. But I don't think anything is going to change in the post-election period. So I think we're going to have a renewable fuel standard for a good long while. And, you know, that has some implications, clearly, for the cattle sector and the pork sector and the poultry sector. But I think those folks are just going to have to live with it and adjust to it. Because there's just a lot of interest in energy-related kinds of programs and the concept of trying to make the U.S. less dependent on energy from imported from countries who are not very friendly with us and might prefer just to destroy us. So that's going to, I think, sustain the interest in renewable fuels for a long time to come.
I agree.
Lynn?
I'm Lynn Henderson, Baker Marketing. You touched on high prices. I'm curious to hear more about your thoughts on the long-term implications of the structure of agriculture on these higher prices. As you know, agriculture is a massive organization with crop producers, livestock producers, credit providers, machinery providers, crop input, all the way up and down the chain. We're even having some young people trying to get into our business. The ag colleges are loaded with students wanting to have a career in agriculture. I'm curious about the long-term implications of how you see this business shaking out over the next 10, 20 years.
I think they're going to have an opportunity in agriculture. You're talking to universities and so forth, the young people. But agriculture is more than the guy that's out there slopping the pigs. Agriculture is a huge industry, and I think a lot of these people can end up with some big companies that serve agriculture in different ways and are part of agriculture. The whole industry's changed so much. I mean, Bob was talking about, you know, how farming was when he grew up, and I could say the same thing. My dad had two old horses. They were pulling a two-row corn planter. It took forever to get anything done. We went out and pulled weeds out of the bean fields. So it's not the same, and it's, frankly, we're not going back to that way of doing it. But what happens every year, as things get bigger and more efficient, frankly, that we've got the most reasonably priced food in the world, less than 10% of disposable family income, we'll feed the family. And so it's just not going to change. In some ways, I regret this, because I know when I grew up, we had families down the road that maybe farmed 100 acres. They'd send two kids to college. Come on, 100 acres, boy, that's not going to even hardly buy enough clothes to clothe you. So, I mean, it's just totally different today. And unfortunately, I think it's going to probably continue to be a big business. Agriculture is very capital intensive today. And at one time, it was labor intensive.
You know, Bob may want to add too, but you know, all of us grew up in at a time when machinery was pretty small. You know, we went from two-row equipment to four-row equipment when I was growing up, and we thought, boy, that four-row equipment was really big stuff. And we could handle twice as many acres as we could previously. I mentioned that I was out at the Farm Progress Show in Iowa this year, and I looked at some of that equipment out there, and I was just in awe. I mean, some of it is just gigantic, as you well know. And this has happened not just in agriculture, but elsewhere. As we indicated earlier, I served for a good number of years on the Caterpillar board, and you should see some of the equipment that Caterpillar manufactures these days as earth-moving equipment compared to what was there previously. When you have trucks that are three highway lanes wide that'll hold 250 or 300 tons of product. That's a, you know, those are big trucks. So this, these changes have happened in other industries as well. I think they'll continue in agriculture because we have a lot of very sophisticated farmers these days. One of the earlier questions by Ken Root was, can a farmer be Secretary of Agriculture? You're darn right. I mean, they're so doggone good, they could run General Motors a lot better than anybody is running General Motors today. So there's plenty of talent out there in American agriculture, and it's going to get better all the time. And some of that's going to come out of universities with students who are really talented. They're not going to be, there's not going to be a lot of room for new young farmers to come on unless they're a part of the family. But as Jack said, there are going to be a lot of good jobs in the food industry, as I would define it. Agriculture, agribusiness, the food industry, and you can add natural resources and energy kinds of things to that. That's why you're seeing a lot of interest on the part of students coming in. Jack and I were at the University of Nebraska on a program just a month or so ago, and the vice chancellor there was telling us that their student population in agriculture has gone up 5 years in a row now and has hit the highest levels ever at Nebraska. I just did some seminars at Purdue about 3 weeks ago, and the folks at Purdue told me exactly the same thing. You know, their numbers are up as well. So you got people that are now excited and enthusiastic about agriculture broadly defined, and I think that's good. And they're going to have some darn good jobs, but not all of them are going to be out on the farm because, as Jack said, we're going to continue to be capital intensive at the farm level.
All right. Let's go to the back of the room.
Yes, I'm James Hunt with KGNC Radio in Amarillo, and I wanted to know what advice you would give to agriculture, to food companies, when it comes to defending modern agricultural practices against the kind of fear-mongering distortions that are undermining consumer confidence at times in various food products.
What specifically are you talking about?
Genetically modified foods, animal health products and animal agriculture, anything that has helped ramp up production at a time when we are seeing the global population grow so much.
Yeah, there's always controversy about the latest in agricultural research. I'm old enough to remember when hybrid corn came on in the 30s, and I had a neighbor that just went nuts. People planting hybrid corn, my God, they're going to poison everybody under the sun and all their pigs with it. They didn't know what they're talking about, but they had this notion. Well, we toughed it out. I think that's true with the GMOs, generally modified organisms, and other kinds of advances in food and tech and agricultural science that is based on just pure poppycock. And the thing we don't do is give in to it. But neither do we ignore it. We try to bring them along and teach them and show them where there is no real risk here. We can't just blow in their ear. We just got to give them stuff they can understand.
Yeah, you do. You can do it.
Just a couple of additional comments there, because that question has international implications as well as domestic. You know, it's not only whether we can sell the product domestically in the face of that kind of demagoguery, but whether we can sell it internationally too. And we can readily have our exports impeded if we're not at all careful. And what that means is that we've got to have people in government too who will insist that we have science-based rules in this arena globally. And I'm sorry to say, we've got a good number of people in governments, including our own, who sometimes are willing to be pretty soft on that subject and bend to the political whims of a given time rather than stand solid for sound science. In agriculture, that's Codex Alimentarius. And we really need to win those battles with the folks around the world who are inordinately risk averse, and that includes most of our folks in our friends in Europe. There is no reason to object to GMOs. genetically modified organisms. There's not one person in this entire world who's gotten sick from eating anything that has been genetically modified in the GMO process. And yet you see a lot of flack there. I don't know what happened in California yesterday. It went down, thank heavens.
Yeah.
But that's good news.
All right, Jeff.
Gentlemen, the same question
that's
for you,
really
though. There is an undereducated, overfunded vocal minority from Proposition 37 in California and 14 other states that have similar either legislation or ballot initiatives, sustainability effort out of the European Union, the forced gestation crates in the industry for swine, and the cage size for poultry. Each one of you were stalwarts for agriculture, the lightning rod to stand up for this industry. If you were secretary today, how would you respond to these accusations that ultimately will affect overall production of agriculture?
Tell the truth. Just tell the truth. And don't back down.
But I think one other thing, I mean, that you're right about that, Bob, but I think that you've got to fight it in two or three different ways. One way is I think this idea that you can't sell eggs in California unless the chickens that laid the eggs were in a certain specific size cage. Even if you're importing eggs, you can't import them from another state in there unless they come from a chicken living in the right kind of environment. And I don't think that's going to be, I think you can challenge that in the courts. I just can't believe that that would stand up if you take it to the courts, and I'm sure it'll go there eventually. But I also think another way, we've just got to work more effectively with the customers. And I'm not talking the processors, I'm talking the citizens that buy the food so that they understand agriculture today. You don't have to go back too many years, like 30 or 40 years, and almost everybody had an uncle or a grandfather or somebody that was on the farm, and you go to the farm in the summertime a little while. Now, everybody's so far removed from that, and the people are all in the cities. And what do they know about what our business? And we're going to have to work to try to educate them. I know we've got ag in the classrooms, which is a good thing, but even there, I don't know if we're reaching anywhere near enough people. It's, I don't know. Clayton, do you know how to fix this?
You know, I don't think anybody has all the answers, Jack or Bob. But boy, it's a serious issue in my judgment. And I think it has gotten worse in recent years. And it's going to take a lot of effort on people in the private sector, including you folks, and farm organizations of all kinds who have an interest, a specific interest in this topic. They've got to stand up and be counted. And within government, I don't want to make this a political statement in any way, but it's not something that just the cabinet officers have to deal with. You can't put this kind of burden totally on Secretary Vilsack or any other Secretary of Agriculture or on whoever heads the Food and Drug Administration or EPA. It's down through those organizations, too, where you've got to have people at the sub-cabinet level and the agency administrator level who will, one, engage in the kind of informational challenge that Jack was talking about, but also stand up and be counted in a regulatory sense. And when people come in making these kinds of demagogic demands, they say no, 1,000 times no, get out of here. So it has to happen in a lot of levels, and I'm sorry to say there are a heck of a lot of people in the Department of Agriculture today who know little about agriculture and don't have the strong feeling about these subjects that some of the people up here at this table have had and do have.
I have a daughter-in-law who's fanatic on the business of buying only organic foods. And we kind of poke fun at her. We kind of think she's foolishness. But she believes it. And she buys only that which is not, which is organically grown. Well, in the American system of commerce and trade and industry, we encourage all diversity of all kinds. I wouldn't pass a rule that says she can't have her way. We ought to let her have it.
We would agree with that, yeah. Except that let's not have organic impose its will on everybody else.
Thank you for being here. Farm Bill, Brazil, and I had one other. Trade, by the way, I'm Tony St. James, all ag, all day, Texas.
Good.
No Farm Bill. If we don't see something happen, Brazilians have already said they'll retaliate. So now we bring in intellectual property rights as well. So my question for you is this on the radar?
This is Clayton's expertise, but I have felt all along that Brazil's complaining about our cotton deal down there. So we buy them off. We're paying them, I don't know, $150 million or something. You know how much it is. To buy them off instead of correcting our farm program to meet the World Trade Organization rules. That's ridiculous. We ought to fix it. Now, will we fix it? Well, there was not any effort in this administration or the Congress to do it this last time around. I don't know.
Jack is right. If we expect other people to abide by the rules of the World Trade Organization, we ought to abide by those rules as well. And there are folks, I'm sorry to say, in this country and in a lot of other countries who'd like to have their cake and eat it too. They'd like other people to follow the rules, but don't have the rules apply to me. This is a little bit like Russell Long used to say about taxes, don't tax you and don't tax me, tax that other fellow behind the tree. trade is a little bit like that. Let us be protectionist, but nobody else be that. That's what came up in cotton. We lost the cotton case in the dispute settlement system of the World Trade Organization. We deserved to lose it. And as a consequence, we should fix it. And as Jack said, we did something we've never done before. We bought off the winner of the case by giving them $140 million and basically agreeing to keep doing that for forever. That's the bad solution. We don't try to buy off people who beat us in a WTO case. What we should do is correct it and follow the rules. Your question, though, is are we going to fix it, or will the Brazilians retaliate, which they have every right to do because they won the case? And the fact is they're ready to retaliate, and it'll come up in intellectual property and some of the other areas where they will retaliate if we don't fix it. Will the Congress fix it? That's kind of like guessing whether or not they're going to fix entitlements. But let's hope so, because, we'll pay a big price. Not only will we suffer retaliation if we don't fix it, but then we've set a precedent for the rest of the world saying, if U.S. beats us in a case, so what? We don't need to fix it. They didn't fix cotton. Why should we fix whatever they want?
All right, floor is open.
Go ahead,
Janet.
One question real quick, pure speculation, since we now have the election decided and all that good stuff's over with. What about the cabinet? Are we going to see some changes in the president's cabinet, of course, including the Secretary of Agriculture? Is he going to stay on or change course?
As an outsider to that process, I have no clue.
Well, the one I can give you a definitive word on, and you probably know already, is that there will be a new U.S. trade representative. That's important because that's a very key spot on all trade issues, particularly the TPP negotiations that are now underway. Our president, USTR, has indicated that he wishes to step down at the end of the first term. And I know from having talked to him that he's serious about that. I don't think there will be any reconsideration of that decision. So the question is, who will come in as the USTR? Nobody knows for sure. I suppose the one who has been highest on the rumor list is a man named Mike Froman, F-R-O-M-A-N, who is on the White House staff, and he would be excellent. He knows trade really well. He had a stint at USTR some years back for a short period of time. He's really handled all the trade issues at the White House over the last 4 years for all practical purposes, and if he were to move from the White House over into USTR, that would be really good news, I think, for all of us if it happens. But that's a presidential decision. That's not Mike Froman's decision. So we'll just have to wait and see. I have not talked with Secretary Vilsack, my guess would be that he will wish to stay on and will probably be asked to stay on. I know he is enjoying the job. He's told me that he really enjoys being Secretary of Agriculture. And that being the case, I think there's pretty strong motivation for him to continue. Having been governor of Iowa, he can't go back and run for the governorship. Maybe he could, but I think it's doubtful that he would want to do that. If I were a betting person, I would probably bet that Secretary Vilsack will stay on, although, you know, that's likewise the decision for the President of the United States, not for any of us.
Anyone else? Please.
Hello, Chris Grams with CME Group. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us this afternoon. This might be a bit of a softball to you, but for those of us who are newer to the agricultural industry, with USDA crop reports, the NAS reports now scheduled to come out at noon Eastern time starting the new year, I'm wondering if you have any perspective how those reports have changed over time. Are they more valuable now with the increases in production we're seeing, for example, in the FSU with wheat, some of the production in South America and soybeans, perhaps just a history lesson, maybe how those reports, crop reports, have changed since you were a part of the USDA and their importance for producers and others today?
The only thing I'd say is I think they're more valuable than they have been in the past because we generally think we've got tight supplies. When you got too much of everything, and in years past where we even had grain stored, the government owned it, didn't make a lot of difference what they reported. But now everybody's got their eyes on it, especially you guys, as you should.
Yeah, go ahead,
Bob. No, get it. I have nothing.
All right. Well, first of all, I'm really happy to see the CME group here since I had the privilege of heading that group years back. And I noticed your signs as I went up the escalators a little while ago. So glad to have you here. On the subject, I think USDA, just to give the department a big pat on the back, I think the USDA has done a better job of maintaining total secrecy, total confidentiality on those reports than anybody in the world. You know, it's just remarkable how well we've been able to keep those reports from leaking out. That's a great testament to the integrity of the employees, civil servants in the Department of Agriculture. And that's been true for years and years to come, as you well know. And we've all experienced that. We've all gone down into the bowels of the system when we've announced those reports. Been a part of how that has taken place. I think the reports, as Jack said, are more valuable today than they've ever been before because of the enormous volatility that we're experiencing in prices today. So the more facts you have, the better decisions you make in anything. And that's true of the traders at CME, or it's true of people out in farm country who are doing some hedging. So, yeah, it's darn important to have them come out. And it's really important to have them be credible and confidential.
Real quick, follow up to Chris. What about the timing? I think you also mentioned the timing, having it come out 7:30, and now they're going to move the times after the first of the year. What do you feel about that with the trade open? Yeah,
Frankly, I don't think it makes a heck of a lot of difference.
I don't have a thought on it.
We are coming to that time. I'm going to, on RFD TV, on our live programs, we give each of our guests closing thoughts, a minute or two. We didn't rehearse this part, but I know it won't be hard for you to kind of give some closing thoughts to our members that have joined us tonight. Secretary Bergman, we'll start with you, go on down the line. Just some closing thoughts as we leave today.
The Congress and the administration are going to have to deal with the whole question of deficits and debt. And it's all going to be very, very tough medicine. There is no simple solution. There is no way this thing is going to get answered without your feet being stepped on hard. And the question is whether we can, as a nation, accept that kind of discipline and make it work, or whether we'll just say no and let it blow up.
Secretary Blatt.
There are two things we didn't talk about today. I think they're very important. You've asked a lot of perfect questions, but I just put them on the table. We're not going to debate them because we're done. But just to remind you, one of them is we're going to be faced with a lot of new taxes if we go off this cliff. And even if we don't, some of things are going to go off the cliff anyway, even if everything doesn't. And in agriculture, we've got a tremendous concern about the death tax and trying to keep family farms together, and this is going to be a bad deal after the first of the year unless we do something about that. And then the other thing I was going to bring up is another issue that's very important to agriculture that's not been solved, and I think that President Obama wants to solve it. He says he does, and that's the immigration problem, and we need to deal with that, because who's going to pick the strawberries and milk the cows and butcher the hogs? We've got to get that fixed. Two things I wanted to bring up, but I thank you for everything. I love being with my friends here.
Jack, I'm glad you mentioned the immigration issue. I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to discuss that, because I think it's one of the most serious issues facing America today, and we've got to deal with that question along with the entitlement issues that we talked about earlier and that Bob mentioned just now. I think these are really critical years that lie just ahead of all of us. We have a tendency to say that every time we have a meeting like this, I suppose. But sometimes they're more critical than others. And I think time has run out on the U.S. in its trillion-dollar annual deficits. The rest of the world just isn't going to permit us to do that. We're financing those trillion-dollar annual deficits basically outside the U.S. And I can tell you, folks in China and elsewhere that are providing that financing today are getting pretty wary about it. They're not too happy. And what they fear is that we will try to solve this problem the easy way. We'll take the easy way out and try to do it by reducing the value of the dollar. And pay these debts off with cheap money. Now, that works to agriculture's advantage to in the short run, because if we have a cheaper dollar, it makes it easier for us to export. In the longer run, though, that will leave us with an inflation problem that will eat us up. And as a nation, we've got to pretty soon decide that there is no cheap, easy way out. That we better start biting the bullet pretty soon if we're not going to go the way of Greece. And we're heading the way of Greece right now. We think we can pull it off because we're the largest nation in the world and everybody else will let us do it. I'm not so sure that argument is going to last any longer. But back to you folks. You do a phenomenal job. And all I say to every one of you is just keep at it. keep doing what you're doing and keep chugging, because you are making valuable contributions to American agriculture.
Let's give a hand and thank you on behalf of all of us here at NAFB.
Good job.